Blog Talk Radio.
Hi everyone, this is Annabelle, and I have an exciting show today. I'm really eager to, I've been wanting to talk to Carolyn Lucas-Meyer for months. She is the president and founder of America Speaks, and she was one of our main speakers at the convention in Louisville, Kentucky in September. And she is someone who has been really committed to pursuing a civil-informed dialogue in America and self-governance for years. And she is really a dedicated professional in this field and has won numerous awards. And I'm eager to talk to Caroline about her passion as well as her new initiative, which is called America Squares, American Square, sorry, AmericanSquare.org. Thanks for joining us, Caroline.
Well, Annabelle, I'm delighted to be with you.
Oh, great. Let's see. I have so much I wanted to ask you. I wanted to start, though, about with kind of a story about how you got started in this field. I know it can be often probably unrewarding and discouraging at times, but you have not given up and you have shown us really a way forward. So can you tell us more about how you got started?
I'd be happy to do that, Annabelle. I had the privilege of serving as the chief of staff to the governor of Ohio from what in the world we live in is a very long time ago, from 1986 to 1991. And in that experience, Annabelle, I really had the opportunity to see up close the frustration on the part of excellent elected officials of both parties, frankly, and the equal frustration on the part of the general public about the lack of opportunity for them to have authentic dialogue with one another. You know, about the only time an elected official actually is in front of ordinary people is during a campaign cycle. And as our media world has completely altered and as information technology has driven us to a 24/7 news cycle, even the campaign trail is now often so orchestrated and so mediated through some organization that even there, that sense of touching and feeling and understanding what people really feel about our country is very difficult for elected officials to achieve.
Mm-hmm.
So we began thinking about it, and while I was in that role, we tried a lot of experiments. You know, once someone is elected, their doorstop is always filled with people and organizations that have a special interest. But if I can refer back to one of our founding fathers, Thomas Jefferson's insight that really excellent public policy comes by the integration of expert knowledge and what he called the wisdom of ordinary people living their lives.
Mm-hmm.
So that set me on the track of thinking about how can you, in the day and age of information technology, bring together large numbers of ordinary people that actually are demographically representative of a particular political jurisdiction and create a safe democratic space for an authentic connection between the people and their elected officials. So that's how it started out for me, Annabelle.
Great. Thank you. Thanks for sharing that. So along the way, so that was how many years ago? 14 years
actually, ago? It was 1995 when I launched and founded America Speaks.
Great. So in that time, I'm wondering, I mean, what are some of the main lessons for you, things that have actually really surprised you in your journey?
Well, you know, the conventional wisdom when I began America Speaks was that ordinary people don't have time to participate, that ordinary people are too focused on NIMBY, not in my backyard, and that ordinary people don't have enough information to deal with these tough, tough issues like debt and deficit. And a last piece was that officials wouldn't listen even if they did. So when we first started out, honestly, Annabelle, we were in an atmosphere which it was necessary to prove to the media and to prove to the public themselves and to prove to elected officials that that conventional wisdom about the public actually isn't real.
Right.
And over 15 years, we've engaged 175,000 people in all 50 states in the United States and in 15 other countries. I'm proud of America to say none of those pillars of conventional wisdom were true.
Mm-hmm.
People don't usually participate because they don't think it's worth their time. They will make time to do it if they know someone is listening. Let me give your listeners a concrete example. And Annabelle, you actually know about this case, but last summer we did a national discussion on our budget and our deficit, our budget and our economy, focusing on reducing the national deficit. We had 3,500 people, completely representative of the U.S. population. They were located in 19 states across the country, linked by information technology, webcast, and satellite. They stayed in those rooms, those convention centers, those libraries for 7 hours on a Saturday. 97% of the people stayed all 7 hours.
Wow.
So that completely debunks the notion that people don't have enough time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's also true in a complex society like ours, they often don't have enough information. So whose responsibility is it to give it to them? And some of your listeners, these participant guides are still up on our website. If people who are listening might want to look at them, we created two guides, one which was like a cliff notes of the federal budget. We called it Federal Budget 101, what every American needs to know to understand what revenues are coming in and how it's spent. And the second booklet had 42 options, about half on cutting spending and about half on raising revenues. So the issue of, it's often true, people don't have enough information, but then it's civil society's job, the government's job, to ensure that the information is available in a way that it is able to be assimilated. And then the whole business about not in my backyard.
Mm-hmm.
Ordinarily, people are asked these kinds of tough questions already in fragmented ways. So, yes, if you pick a particular four or five blocks in a neighborhood in a city and ask them whether a group home for mentally disturbed people or substance abusers should be put in that three or four block area, of course, what are you going to hear? No. But if you take those same three or four blocks and you embed it in the overall, we've actually done this in Washington, D.C., Annabelle, so this is a real example. And we say, here's a map of the city. We need these many neighborhood-based locations for group homes for people with mental illness and substance abuse issues. We want to distribute them across the city. Collectively help us make the decision about the six best locations. When people think about the whole city and benefiting the whole population, a fair number of those people in the same three or four original blocks, guess what? They approve that group home being in their neighborhood.
Interesting.
So we rarely ask people in a way that taps into their values about the community they want to live in.
Mm-hmm. Right. But it also sounds like kind of enlarging the scope of the problem so they see it more in totality, more holistically, instead of how it affects them. Right?
Exactly. Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
And even think in a smaller scale situation, you have a choice of defining the problem only as it impacts me, and I do have to understand how it impacts me, but I'm going to make a more holistic decision if I see the whole picture.
Right. So
and then
that's
also
where,
very important, the last piece of conventional wisdom that I mentioned, Annabelle, was that people saying elected officials wouldn't listen. And in our experience, elected officials, they have to be brought in and briefed at the front end. They have to understand what the questions are. But we have had tremendous success in mayors actually changing priorities in their budgets, in regional planning commissions taking a broader, deeper look at the impacts on the population, and in the Our Budget, Our Economy, the President's Commission actually using the data that came from that public process as they were formulating their recommendations.
Interesting. So, Carolyn, I'm just wondering, you know, in the last 15 years, you've been, you know, completely engaged in this pursuit. I mean, do you feel that because our, not just because of 24/7 news cycle, but for many, probably other reasons as well, you know, we have become more polarized as a country, so dialogue often feels like a fight. And it is really going, I mean, against your model, what you're proposing, our culture trend is more towards still that kind of ultimate fighting type of model of, you know, political engagement. Does it just feel that way, or do you agree with that?
Well, actually, Annabelle, I'm going to give my experience in my own life, and I think if listeners, again, for all of us, that depends on what decade you are in your life, but I would say there is no question but what a very large shift in American life in general, and then I'll come to your specific question about our political discourse. There are fewer opportunities for most people to have daily interactions with people who are profoundly different than they are than was the case in an earlier stage of American life. Our housing patterns have become more segmented both by income and by political philosophy. There is a great book called The Big Shift that I think documents this better than anything else I've read. I'm not remembering exactly at the moment the author's name. It's Bill. It'll come to me. But so it used to be that people lived in neighborhoods where they were more likely to bump up against people from different religions than their own, from different political views than their own, and that is less likely to be true today than it was previously. In the way our media has become more profit-driven and fragmented, it means people are likely to be listening to media sources that match their existing view and interpretation of facts as well as political philosophy. So in an interesting way, Annabelle, it's why it's even more critical that efforts like everyday democracy, like deliberative polling, like the Coffee Party, like America Speaks, have to take some initiative for creating the spaces where people interact with each other across their differences. But now let me go specifically to political dialogue. And I do think it's a change, and I do think it should be of high concern. Until recently, frankly, I had not seen examples, and maybe in earlier cycles of American history, but not in my adulthood, had I ever seen elected officials actually themselves publicly encouraging people, ordinary people, to be disrespectful, to be completely judgmental of someone who thinks differently than they do. And in any culture, when people in authority begin to legitimate a different kind of public behavior, then you begin to see that public behavior demonstrated more frequently. So, yes, I think we all should be concerned about a reduction in civil discourse across our differences in public spaces. I think we should be very concerned about it.
Right. I mean, it's really interesting to me that when you do set up the situation, just the way you're describing, set up the situation so that it really is about people coming together for kind of problem solving, that it's almost like they've entered a different game because they're so used to thinking about politics as a kind of football game or wrestling match where it's there are two clear sides, and it's about one person or one group losing and the other group winning. But if you set it up as a collective problem-solving situation, the game changes, the rules change, and the outcome changes, right?
Yep.
And so I guess, you know, we're trying to figure out, you know, how we can do this, really, because it does have to happen at the individual psychological level, where people make that shift, like, okay, I don't have to enter this political process as a game about winning and enter it as people coming together to work together and collaborate. And, you know, I'm just wondering, if, like, what are tools that we can use? And I guess we can kind of segue into the work you're doing now with American Square. Like, what are some tools that we can use to really encourage that mental shift?
You know, Annabelle, if you don't mind, before I talk about the tools and the design is the other very, very important principles, I'd actually like to give your listeners a very concrete example of the profoundness of what you just said. When we did the national discussion on our budget, our economy,
mm-hmm.
the MacArthur Foundation gave two universities a very wonderful grant to do evaluation research on the project.
Mm-hmm.
So as people entered the day, before they saw the fact books, before they started the dialogue, every participant answered survey questions about their views on what should be done about the budget deficit,
mm-hmm.
the debt and deficit, mm-hmm. and it was almost predictable. The people who identified themselves as moderately liberal or liberal, at the early in the morning, about something over 80% of them said they would not cut entitlement spending at all. And the flip side of the coin, those people who identified themselves as somewhat conservative or conservative said that under no circumstances would they raise revenues.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the reality about the size of the U.S. deficit is mm-hmm. to get there, you have to do both.
Mm-hmm.
And so once the day started and they saw the full picture of the numbers, they saw that what's generated by raising the retirement age on Social Security or by changing the tax rates on certain groups or by getting rid of tax entitlements, by the end of the you used the exact words, the American character and culture, which was identified and described by de Tocqueville in the mid-1800s,
mm-hmm.
is that we are problem solvers. We want to take action. That's
mm-hmm.
who we are as a culture. So people
right.
left their ideological positions in order to solve the problem that we gave them of cutting $1.2 trillion from the deficit by 2025. And
mm-hmm.
when those same individuals filled out their post-survey, more than 84% of the liberals did cut entitlement spending, and more than 87% of the conservatives did raise taxes. So where we're caught is
mm-hmm.
when people are responding to the specific signals in the electoral process and the partisan demagoguing on issues,
mm-hmm.
they respond one way. When you
mm-hmm.
give them, as you called it, the tools, and I added the design, to take
mm-hmm.
some responsibility for solving the problem themselves, other than a very small percentage, both on the right and on the left, never more than 12 or 13 probably, and often less, leave those ideological positions and move to collectively solving the problem.
Mm-hmm.
So the issue
That's
that
great.
You asked me about is there aren't very many places in our culture that
mm-hmm.
set up the social norms, provide the information, and reward people for behaving that way.
Right. Exactly.
The fact
yeah.
So your question about tools.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and maybe this is a time to also for me to just invite people to look at the experiment that America Speaks is trying right now called the American Square, which you could even go to online while Annabelle and I are talking. It's just www.theamericansquare.org. What we wanted to see, we've been had such success in 15 years when we bring people together face-to-face in this kind
mm-hmm.
of problem-solving. We wanted to see if you could create that kind of space on the web and keep it as respectful and open to influencing one another's views as we see happens when people are sitting face-to-face. I mean, when we did this, Our Budget, Our Economy, last year, all of the tables, many of the tables, had people from the Tea Party, people from MoveOn.org at the same table who started in drastically different positions and ended the day not necessarily agreeing with each other and everything, but who problem-solved together. So the notion is, can we replicate that in a completely web environment?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think, Annabelle, you know some of the things that make it more complicated is that in the web environment, it is possible for people to actually respond very, very quickly without much social context.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're in a threaded discussion, even when it's moderated. So by definition, you are one by one by one responding to the original idea. So it's essential in terms of your tools question. Number one, essential that the site set up some norms for meaningful, civil, respectful discussion at the front end.
Mm-hmm.
And that there's a, in our case, we're asking people to become members of a community, and that when you sign on to be a member of a community, you're agreeing to operate in that public space as according to those normative conditions. So, but it's also essential that there be someone who's moderating the space, so that if someone comes on the space and violates that, in terms of the kind of language they use, in terms of the kind of insults that they might direct to another person, then
mm-hmm.
they need to be responded to immediately. It's also important that the quality of the content on those sites is up to date and changes
mm-hmm.
frequently in the kind of standards that we expect online. Maybe one of the most difficult things, Annabelle, and I'd love to hear what your experience is given that already on the internet, the blogosphere particularly tends to organize itself around a predisposed philosophy. So
mm-hmm.
if you're a conservative, you go to these five sites. If you're a liberal, you go to these five sites.
Yeah.
So it's how to do the outreach for the site that brings conservatives, moderates, and liberals into a place where their expectation is not just to have affirmation of their pre-existing ideas, but where they're actually having the courage to openly exchange ideas respectfully with someone who thinks differently than they do. Does that help with your question?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is great. I love talking about this. So thank you for joining us on this discussion. But I think it is really difficult because we are self-segregated people, like to talk to other people who agree with them. But then there are others who seek out fights. They go out looking for conflict. And I guess online a lot of people refer to them as trolls because their intention is to not engage in dialogue but to disrupt dialogue. So it is very difficult given how self-segregated we are. But I do feel like there are so many people, and I don't know if they fit in that category that pollsters like to create, the independent voters, but there are so many people who see the brokenness of not only the two-party system but our current national dialogue. And they really want and crave a sense of civility and real dialogue. And so I feel they're out looking for it. They're hunting for it. You know, there are people who I think will eventually find the coffee party or the work you're doing because they're determined to, like we are, like you and I are, we're determined to have that civil, informed dialogue. I mean, I think it's so powerful, that desire. And so important to the democratic process. So eventually, it may take some time, but I think eventually we'll find each other. We'll find the people who want to work towards that dialogue, and then hopefully we can really set that as the norm for our country. So I guess I feel like it's sort of a long journey to that point where it feels like all of our intentions are set on this dialogue as opposed to, you know, winning our partisan fights.
I think you've said it very well. We also find people hungry to
mm-hmm.
be hungry to have their own voices heard, and
mm-hmm.
goodness knows there are many marginalized populations in this country that have had to struggle for decades, century to actually be heard.
Mm-hmm.
And that people also, I think there's no question but what the desire for the possibility of civil interchange in public spaces, you know, the kind of outpouring we heard from all across the country after the horrendous incident in Tucson when Representative Gabby Gifford was shot and when several people were killed. And we're quick to pass that off as the single action of an unbalanced mind. But, you know, people are operating in a social context in which there does seem to be a lack of normative constraints for that kind of aberrant behavior. So, you know, Annabelle, while we've been talking, the people have been posting on your Blog Talk Radio, and mm-hmm. I do want to respond to one thing that's come up, if I can.
Sure.
The question is, what about people who are uneducated? What about, to quote him, a guy in the ghetto or a guy in the barrio? Absolutely. I mean, when America Speaks Works, we go to great lengths in every community to ensure that it is truly representative of the whole population of that community, including unregistered documents. People do not have documents registered yet, and including people who are not literate. So mm-hmm. American society is an extraordinary quilt of unimaginable complexity. And mm-hmm. for us to deal with these questions most effectively, every person has the right to be heard, and mm-hmm. work needs to be done to ensure that they have the opportunity to be heard.
Mm-hmm. That's great. I'm really glad to hear you say that. I mean, I think one thing, you know, we try to talk about in the coffee party is that diversity is a strength. I mean, this is why we are a strong country, ultimately, because we're diverse. Because I think it's so easy to get caught up feeling like, oh, we have such irreconcilable differences in this country, and it makes people want to throw up their hands and give up and say we can never really have a kind of collective or national harmony because we're so different. And you know, really trying to harness that those differences so that it actually becomes a strength. I think that was in the original kind of idea of America, you know, creating a kind of government that would draw on that strength of our differences, our individual expressions. But I think it's right now with the kind of vicious fighting we see, I think it's very easy to just feel defeated and discouraged, you know. So, I mean, I'm really glad to hear you say that that's part of the design, your design as well, that you want to include all those people and bring them to the table, and ultimately that's going to make for a better outcome. Go ahead, Carol.
I was just going to say, to me, there's a kind of terrible irony about what you were just talking about in terms of the issue of, do we value diversity or mm-hmm. do we in some way demonize diversity? If you look mm-hmm. throughout the history of this country right from the beginning, mm-hmm. our major leaps forward were directly connected to our ability to absorb waves and waves and waves of immigration from all over the world. And yes, again, the complexity of that has changed. The way in which we receive information about who we are and what our core differences are has shifted. But there's no question in my mind but our ability to remain competitive in the global economy, our ability to build healthy communities on a local level,
mm-hmm.
have to include our capacity to respect difference. And at the same time, to actually come to a deeper understanding that deeply, deeply at the core, our human identity is essential as well as our unique difference in identity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, thanks. I mean, it's great talking to you because it's so reassuring you know, that we're on the right path with the coffee party because we're so in agreement, and the fact that you are pursuing what you're doing, you haven't been discouraged from your path, and you're producing all this really creative work, adapting to the times. It's really encouraging. let's see.
Thank you, Annabelle, and it is wonderful to see how what responded when you spoke up, mm-hmm. and how people have responded. I think that's something maybe neither of us have emphasized enough on this call,
mm-hmm.
is that some spark, some person who has the courage to stand up and say what they believe,
mm-hmm.
is very often the pebble that starts the ripple that creates enough of a sense of community, enough social support to actually begin to bring people together to shift into this problem-solving space as opposed into a very poisonous partisan space. And I'm sure the same is I respect partisan politics. It's core to part of the structure and the way our democracy works.
Mm-hmm.
But we're now in a phase of hyper-partisanship that goes
right.
beyond the value of codifying those differences into a party philosophy. We're now seeing the stepping over of the line to disrespect and judgment about me as a human being because I think differently than you do. But I don't want to lose my, where I started here is the courage
mm-hmm.
to actually give voice to one's own deepest beliefs and concerns
mm-hmm.
is a critical step in creating the public safety necessary for us to come together to problem solve.
Definitely. I guess for me, I sense bully tactics, the people who were really aggressive about attacking the healthcare reform bill, whereas they might have had very valid concerns about the bill, I felt like they were using bully tactics in the end. And I feel like that is sort of a perennial problem in our politics, is that, there's a lot of bullying going on and people feel intimidated by those tactics. All I said really was we should be talking with civility and work towards cooperation, really, at the beginning of the coffee party. And I got attacked by a lot of people, including Rush Limbaugh. Apparently, Rush Limbaugh started attacking the coffee party when we came on. it was just quite an honor to be attacked by Rush Limbaugh. But that's really all I said, and people made up all kinds of crazy rumors about me, saying things like I was a Chinese spy, even though I'm not even Chinese, and all sorts of other things. And it's hard for people to sort out, like, oh, is this valid, it's not valid. And that missing filter, I guess, is where we've been really trying to figure things out, like how do we get people to use their common sense to question these things that are just thrown at them in the public airwaves right now. And that's a tough thing.
It's a very tough thing, and I applaud your courage for standing your ground even under meaningless, ridiculous attacks for speaking just a basic reality about the world we're living in.
Yeah.
So,
mm-hmm.
two things that you said that I think are a way that people can take action in their local communities.
Oh, by the way, Carolyn, I don't want to interrupt you, but we actually do have a couple of calls.
I don't want to
get to the point where we run out of time before I get to them. But go ahead. So I'll let you.
Okay. Well, let me just make this quick point, and then let's take the calls.
Mm-hmm.
But the first is, in the same way that you and I have been describing, there's been a degrading of public space around our politics,
mm-hmm.
the incidence of bullying in schools has increased
mm-hmm.
dramatically.
Yes.
And I think the skills that are needed to stand up to a bully and
mm-hmm.
the social strengths that need to operate in schools, not just in the classrooms, but in the playgrounds, in the hallways, in the bathrooms,
mm-hmm.
So I think another place to take a stand is the issue of anti-bullying campaigns in schools and in communities.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. That would be a great thing to actually problem solve and build dialogue around, the problem of bullying. I'm glad you brought that up.
And who knows what... who knows what happens to a particular young person that they fall into the pattern themselves of being the bully.
Mm-hmm.
And what we need to do is actually identify both what the parents need for help with the management of that child, and
mm-hmm.
the child having enough safe space to discover what motivates them, what triggers them to
mm-hmm.
engage in aggressive, really domineering, sometimes intent to harm other children. The second point that was a big surprise to me as we began working a lot in other countries, and maybe you're fully aware of this, Annabelle, but my first experience of it was throughout Latin America, that there are very sophisticated media literacy curriculums taught in public schools beginning in elementary school.
Hmm.
And it's a recognition that multimedia, particularly the visualization multimedia, is bombarding children continually, and that they
right.
actually need to be taught
mm-hmm.
how to analyze, how to dissect the
mm-hmm.
images and information that are coming at you. So I think, you know, really asking the right questions as to whether your community schools and potentially even church programs are helping young people learn about media literacy would be a very critical building block of our civil society.
Wow. That's great. I hadn't thought of that. That's really great. Okay, so let's go to a couple of questions. Okay. Hi, you're on the air with Annabelle and Carolyn.
Is that me?
Yes, that's you.
Oh, wonderful. Hello, Ms. Lucas-Meyer. I'm a public speaker, a paid professional. I'm also a listener. I have a psychology degree, and I am a what would be called someone who listens very intently and hears things. And I have to tell you that I've been listening to your speech this morning, and you used a word several times that made me wince.
Mm-hmm.
And let me tell you what that word is. Ordinary. You have described the American people as ordinary. And I thought, well, maybe I was wrong in my predilection to wincing. And so I looked up the definition. Let me tell you what it is. Commonly encountered, usual, of no exceptional ability, degree, or quality. Average, of inferior quality, second rate. And you have described the American people, it doesn't matter what side they're on, as inferior in relation to government officials. I believe that was a quote that you used where you were talking
about how you were in
government.
Let's let Carolyn respond.
No. I'm sorry, sir. I didn't catch your name.
Madam.
What's your name?
You may call me Harry if you'd like.
Okay. Carolyn, do you want to respond?
Well, I just wanted to say that, number one, this is very interesting to me. I use the word ordinary to apply to myself,
mm-hmm.
and I have not ever stopped to look it up in Webster's, and there's no intention on my part to
mm-hmm.
have the connotation that you're suggesting by the use of the word. I definitely will think about it. It's frankly a word I've used often with many, many people living their lives in the country, people from all walks of life. But I know, sir, that I did not say anything to imply that ordinary Americans, in the way I was using the frame, were inferior to people in government. And I think probably what you're quoting, I was not quoting because I don't have the quote in front of me, but I made a reference to Thomas Jefferson saying that the best public policy comes from the integration of expert knowledge
mm-hmm.
and the wisdom that comes from ordinary people.
Right.
That may be what you're referring to. And I'm not sure that Jefferson said ordinary people, but what he was referring to was the farmers and the tradesmen and the, again, Americans of all walks of life, who because of living their lives carry a kind of wisdom that
mm-hmm.
is unique and different than someone deeply trained in an expert professional silo.
Right.
So
well,
I'll take a look at whether I should find a word other than ordinary to capture the difference. What I mean is Americans of all walks of life living their lives in this country.
Mm-hmm. I completely understood what you were saying. So I think that's the ordinary definition of ordinary. So I will move on to the next caller. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, is that me?
Yes, that's you.
Hey, ladies, it's Vince in the Bay. I'm out here in San Francisco, and it's a breath of fresh air to hear two lovely, intelligent individuals such as yourself trying to conduct a civil conversation on the issues. And I might not agree with everything that you ladies are spewing here on the air, but I am encouraged by the fact that you are trying to bring a civil discourse back to the airwaves, and kudos to you for that. However, I think bullying is a term that you can apply it to a lot of different scenarios, and I think bullying really lies in the eye of the beholder, if you will. If you think about when you were bullied as a kid, from your perspective on the playground, when you got nailed in the head with that plastic ball or whatever it is, the rubber ball, you know, that stupid thing you have to play kickball with as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Now you interpreted that as bullying when you got nailed in the face, in the forehead with that when you were on the schoolyard. But maybe that person wasn't intending to bully you. Maybe they just simply had a personal vendetta to bring against you, and that's how you know when the people don't have a good hold of the issue is when they start going to personal attacks. And a lot of people complain about being bullied because they don't have a good grasp of the issues, and they can't respond
to
an
argument. I think we understand.
And then sometimes.
Thank you. So I think, you know, the caller is saying we need to clarify better what was meant by bullying.
Yeah, I use that term in the way I think it's being used pretty standardly in schools, not as an example of a playground incident where, yes, somebody really did kick the ball intentionally at me because they were mad at me at that moment or whatever, but it's much more the small, lithesome boys who someone chooses to begin to start calling them gay or start treating them in a very derogatory way. So I think at this stage, bullying is pretty standardly accepted to be an attack against your person that is by definition repeated and degrading over a period of time. And I definitely would not call the playground example bullying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
That Vince had a very important point that in our political discourse, I think you're probably right, Vince, that people resort to kind of bullying behavior when in fact they are feeling like they're losing ground in the argument,
mm-hmm.
or feeling like they actually can't support a deeply strong emotional reaction with any data.
Right. Yeah, no, that's a really interesting point. I guess when I used it, I was referring to this the intention, which I think is to degrade. I think the right word is degrade. Degrade our people. I think that's really where that's the thing that makes me wince. The first caller talked about how the word ordinary made him wince. I think when I hear speech or I see behavior meant to degrade others, that makes me wince, that there's something really wrong when that's the norm. And it's become the norm in politics to degrade people who disagree with you, you know. And that's what I think needs to change ultimately, you know, is the intention that, you know, we have to engage with each other in a way that will lead to agreement and not agreement, to solutions. and consensus rather than to just simply degrade the other person until we get our way. I mean, just that's really not in the spirit of democracy and what was intended as part of the American experiment. So, you know, so that, I know that's the thing that's driving me to do what I'm doing.
That makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah. I want to ask you, so this experiment that you're engaged in right now, the online experiment, the American Square, what's the plan there? I mean, are you planning on just trying to engage as many people as possible, or are you going for quality, or what's the strategy there?
Well, here was our intention was to discover if we could build a space on the internet, the American Square, that would bring people from all places on the ideological spectrum into a dialogue with one another that stayed civil, that stayed respectful. And yes, we are interested in engaging as many people as possible, and what we're hoping over time is that people themselves will, if you're on the site now, you'll see that people are responding to ideas that have been put out by a balanced group of experts, and we're hoping over time, as has begun to happen, that people will begin to create their own content, so they will take off on an idea about the implications of raising the retirement age as a way to cut for Social Security benefits as a way to cut entitlement spending and pursue the differential impacts of that depending on your whether you're a white-collar job or a blue-collar job or how disability figures into it or whatever the example might be. And then, frankly, Annabelle, if this seems to take hold and there's really interesting exploration down the road, we hope to actually link policymakers into the discussion real time in the same way that we do when we're doing our face-to-face public engagement.
Great.
Also,
oh, that's great.
We also think that it would be we'll keep the space on debt and deficit, but to create, if I can say it this way, another block on the American Square that takes on a different issue, maybe immigration, maybe climate change. So that's, we number one have to see if we can keep balanced participation in terms of people all across the spectrum and have it both be high-quality discussion and civil and respectful. And then we'd like to add decision makers, and then we'd like to add additional issues.
Okay. Actually, we have a couple more calls. So hope you don't mind taking them. Okay.
Good.
Hi,
no,
you're on the air.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, yes. I've been following the conversation both here on the blog and online on Facebook. And I wanted to point out that the first two previous callers seem to zero in on semantics more than on the topic at hand. And I just wanted to try to add to the conversation on that point. There is a fantastic book out by George Lakoff called Moral Politics. And it talks about how the differences between the right and left mainly lie in the way they think and the way they process verbiage. And so what one person may consider to be the definition of a word is not the manner in which the other side would be using that word. So for your listeners out there and anybody else who's interested in really getting down to the crux of where the differences in the two parties lie, I would suggest picking up a copy of Moral Politics by George Lakoff and giving it a good read.
Well, thank you. Okay. Carolyn, do you want to respond to
that? Yeah, no, I have not read it myself, but it sounds very interesting. Thank you very much for the suggestion.
Okay. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Carolyn.
Yes.
Yes. I was listening to the callers, and the first caller, you seemed like you were on the defensive from him, but I think he was trying to just point out to you what he was hearing, and you were, instead of, I think, looking at other ways to say that, but you were trying to defend that you have been saying it for so long that maybe it's possible that it's been incorrect all this time. And
thank you. Okay.
Well, actually, I, number one, didn't feel defensive and didn't want to sound defensive, and what I wanted to clear up was that I knew I had not said what he suggested about the government being superior. But I hope you also heard that I said that I thought he made a very important point and that I was going to try to look into a different word that captured what I had been intending.
Yeah, that's what I heard as well, Carolyn. Okay, one more. Hi, you're on the air.
Would that be me?
Yes, that's you.
Oh, good. Yeah, very interesting discussion. I just found it quite by accident, but I'm delighted that you're doing this. And I have read the George Lakoff book, and I think Lakoff's work is really excellent. I wanted to recommend another book that really sheds a lot of light on the difficulties of communicating with people who radically disagree with you, and it's a book by a guy named Bob Altermeyer.
Mm-hmm.
He's a psychology professor up at the University of Manitoba, I believe. And he's published this book. It's been available online in its entirety for a long time, and I recently acquired an audiobook copy of it for a pretty reasonable price. And
what's
he's done,
the name of it?
It's called The Authoritarians.
Mm-hmm.
And he's done a tremendous amount of research in creating something he called an RWA scale, which stands for Right-Wing Authoritarian Scale. He's been
mm-hmm.
fascinated with how a significant part of the population seems to be virtually impervious to the influence of facts or data or anything that would in any way call their belief system into question. And he uses the term, it's right-wing, that doesn't necessarily apply to people's political stance, although it often does. But because he points out there can be right-wing authoritarian people who are of a left-wing persuasion, such as true believers in communism.
Wait, but let me ask you something. I mean, is he
sure.
saying that these are permanent, somehow genetically codified?
No.
Or,
no,
he's just
basically done the research to show that there is a significant part of the population. I think he estimates that in the United States it's between 20 and 25% of the population are people who have grown up in such a way, and it remains, you know, open to question whether some of this is genetic or some of this is hereditary or whatever. He's not making any statements about that. He's simply saying, look, there is a significant part of the population that is virtually bulletproof, at least at first glance, to anything that would call into question beliefs that are deeply, deeply held and in a very emotional way. And so,
right.
And that they're quite capable of actually holding completely dichotomous beliefs at the same time without recognizing that that's true.
Okay, well, let Carolyn respond. Thank you so much. Okay. Carolyn, what do you think about that?
Well, I think that cognitive science has made great advances in the last couple of decades. And I don't believe that the caller gave us his name, but I think it would verify what he is suggesting, that the author is suggesting, that it is entirely possible for human beings to hold contradictory ideas at the same time without actually grasping the implications of the fact that they are contradictory.
Mm-hmm.
I think equally important is all of the work that has been done in the various, the actual locations. And this brain science is certainly not my field, so I'm not going to be able to give the names here, but that in our hormonal system, when different areas of the brain are stimulated,
mm-hmm.
that, for example, I know one of them is the amygdala, which is an emotional center in your brain, that once that has been stimulated, until it runs its cycle through the biochemistry of your body and brain, it'll be almost impossible for you to respond to rational data, because at that point, your brain is operating from a different control center.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the understanding of that is linked to the importance of us all learning civil, respectful behavior so that we are not triggering one another either accidentally or intentionally.
Right.
So, again, this is not my field, but I do believe that we have learned that, that much more is now transparent as
right.
to what is happening to someone who seems to be just deadlocked in an emotional conflict.
Mm-hmm.
There is a reality to it. Until, in fact, some time has passed, until they have been removed from the argument itself,
mm-hmm.
it's not going to be possible for them to shift to a different level of discourse.
Yeah. Well, you know, I feel very ambivalent when I hear about other scientific, you know, other cognitive science research on this, or even sociological research on this, about deep differences between liberals and conservatives. It kind of reminds me of those studies about men and women, the differences, intrinsic differences or profound differences between men and women, or between African-Americans and whites or whatever. I mean, I guess it's interesting to consider data. It's always interesting to consider data, but I often feel like something goes wrong in the interpretation or application. Like, how do we apply this? What does that mean? Do you then go on to say, okay, you know, these conservatives or right-wing people or these crazy left-wing liberal people, I can't even deal with them. I can't be in the same room with them because there's something wrong with their brain, you know. So I have trouble kind of digesting some of that without resistance.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, so I want to have a more optimistic view that we are constantly in the process of changing and learning and growing and going through various metamorphoses, and that, you know, part of the magic of living is that is the possibility for us to change, and that we can have profoundly positive influence on how we change. And so that's why, I mean, I like how you present the problem, and the work you've done is the transformative power, seeing the transformative power of dialogue and the kind of liberating experience of really being part of a democracy of self-governance. And so, you know, I feel like some of those so-called the truths about our differences get in the way of really believing in the power of dialogue.
I think you have very well articulated that a challenge is any time you generalize if something that has a biological basis is therefore generalizable to the entire category, whether that's male, female, black,
right.
white, whatever it is, by definition at that point you have limited the zone of my ability to create my own experience.
Exactly.
So
exactly,
I think there it is important to understand new breakthroughs and their value in a deeper understanding of the interconnection between thinking and emotion, or the interconnection between thinking and behaving. But, you know, your instinct to be skeptical of the overgeneralization of any generic, therefore all women, therefore all men, absolutely. It's a leap that is not justifiable on data.
Yeah. Well, we have to wrap up, unfortunately. We do have one more caller, but we're running out of time, but I encourage everyone to call back next time. Thank you so much, Carolyn, for joining us this hour. We have learned a lot, and I just commend you for all the work you're doing and your passion, your obvious passion for it, and it's very inspiring. And I'm so glad that you're able to join us, and I will be speaking to you on your online experiment, americansquare.org.
Annabelle, thank you very much for inviting me, and I look forward to seeing you on the American Square.
Okay. Thank you, everyone. Right. Please join us for the next call and on Carolyn's site. Bye.
Bye-bye.